This is SFU Ideas and Issues. I'm Katina Denabasis. Intellectual property rights issues are a hot-button topic these days, with patent disputes, pirating, file sharing, and unlocking of digital products dominating much of the conversation in the media. However, IP issues are also an important area of concern for Indigenous peoples. One project that is garnering international attention and acclaim is called Intellectual Property Issues in Cultural Heritage, also known as IPINCH. This project is a unique academic initiative that is globally based. It combines academics, Indigenous peoples, and policymakers around the world to identify issues that pertain to cultural heritage, which includes both material and immaterial property or remains. The goal of IPINCH is to develop ethically sound practices to avoid conflict and to ensure equitable distribution of research benefits to communities as well as to researchers. I sat down with SFU-based archaeologist, project director, and co-developer of IPINCH, Dr. George Nicholas, to learn some of the basics of IPINCH. Here we cover the inspiration, the challenges, the methods, and some of the achievements of IPINCH to see how this project is one that is working towards decolonization. What inspired you to develop this project?
The project came about through discussions about 10 years ago with colleagues who were realizing that, first of all, with the case of ancient human remains, this was causing great consternation among Indigenous peoples, and this led to what's called the reburial and repatriation debates that really changed how archaeology was being done and led to certain legislation that limited certain kinds of archaeological research, in part because archaeologists for a century or more had been collecting human remains without really being responsible for ensuring their quick study or to work with the descendant communities whose ancestors they were in a way that was both respectful and that made it clear what the benefits of that kind of research was. And so we realized that there was an emerging set of issues relating to intellectual property or intangible heritage, the values that material culture has, not the material items themselves. We saw that emerging as something that could have equal impact on the discipline of archaeology and cultural heritage and so on. So we thought it was better to be proactive rather than reactive, and this led us to discussions with colleagues and the idea of developing this kind of project that would bring academics to work with communities as well as policymakers and other stakeholders to achieve a more balanced resolution in terms of how these issues emerge again, to develop ways to avoid conflicts emerging in the first place.
So then what kind of struggles did you and your collaborators face in getting this project off the ground?
Well, there were, you know, a number of different levels of challenges. And the first was, of course, to figure out amongst ourselves what would work and what would be the best approach. So, you know, this led to internal discussions amongst colleagues and myself. And once we had a sense of how to go forward, we then developed a proposal to Canada's Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council for their major collaborative research program. And this would provide funding of up to $2.5 million for a seven-year project. We submitted the first proposal, and we were rather naive in putting this together, but they really liked it. So while we were not a finalist in that year's competition, we were invited to reapply. And we then reviewed what we had done. We developed better ways to do it and submitted another proposal with a larger team. And this time we were finalists, which meant going from a group of 40 or 50 down to a group of three or four, going to Ottawa to be interviewed by them. But they didn't buy us. They didn't buy the project. They really, really liked it. But they didn't like our research methodology, which was ground up, not top down as usual academic projects go. Well, in any case, we were finalists three more times. So it took us four attempts, 4 years of going after this, until in 2007, late in 2007, we were awarded $2.5 million for this project. So that was the first big challenge, is convincing them, and we finally did that. Our methodology was the only way we could go forward with this. The second set of challenges was actually affecting the kind of research strategy that we thought necessary, and this meant talking to various indigenous communities that have actually signed on from the beginning to partner with us, because they realized they had issues relating to tangible and intangible heritage. Many of our team members had a long history of working with some of these communities themselves, so it was a partnership from the very beginning. But then we ran into challenges in terms of developing our community-based research programs. And the way this kind of research works is that the community works with us to develop the proposal for the particular initiative we were funding. They would approve the methodology. They would be involved in every aspect of it, including data collection. They would have final say over what gets released as a result of the research. And all of that was very straightforward. Where we run into problems was with university ethics offices, as well as the grant transfers. The universities love to deal with other universities. Very simple, and everything's in place. You just do the paperwork. But when you're dealing with indigenous communities, there's a lot of universities just don't know how to deal with them very effectively. And you know, you're dealing with cross-cultural interactions, so it's a lot different from working with an organization in the same society. We're dealing with different societies with different values, different timelines, different value systems, different legal regimes, in a sense. So it gets interesting.
So intellectual property and cultural heritage is incredibly broad in scope. Can you shed some light as to what kind of issues or things are included in this domain of research?
Intellectual property is basically a Western legal concept. And we're talking about copyrights and patents and trademarks and so on. And those are designed basically to protect the inventor or the artist, to ensure that they get value back for their efforts and so on. There are also the equivalents of this in non-Western societies. They may be, not known by those terms. And one of the important distinctions is when we're talking about songs or stories or images or, other expressions of intangible heritage, that the value is not for economic purposes, but their cultural values, religious values. Only some families have the right to display certain masks, certain songs, certain images, and others have to have permission to use them if they have access at all to them. In IPINCH, we're looking at issues of commodification and appropriation of images and stories and so on out of context, or when is it appropriate, when it is allowable to use those images. We're looking at cultural tourism. Who controls the cultural tourism? Is it the indigenous society, or is it someone coming in and marketing that society with only limited benefits going to those communities? We're looking at bioarchaeology and genetics, and who's benefiting from the information from some of these scientific studies. We're looking at a number of issues like this that touch on many different realms of heritage that have relevance economically, socially, culturally, religiously, for different people. So it's all of this stuff is wrapped together in indigenous societies, where in Western society we easily separate things out. So that's another area of challenge in terms of how do you deal with things that are fundamentally different in those societies than they are in Western societies?
Mm-hmm. So you're trying to find that common ground, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So then the work you also do is participatory, action-based research, or community-based participatory research. Can you explain a little bit about what that means and perhaps how it is related to ethnography?
Well, this is, essentially at the heart of our case studies, as I mentioned. So this is where the researcher goes to the community and, you know, either helps them to identify what their issues are, or if the issues are known, simply to go and help them develop the kinds of questions that they want to ask, the kinds of goals that they want to pursue, to develop an appropriate methodology, to develop the best way to get information. It could be a focus group, it could be surveys, it could be interviews, it could be archaeological research. I mean, it just depends upon the kind of questions being pursued. And this basically makes the community a full, not only a full and equal research partner, but puts them in the driver's seat. That they're the ones making the decisions. And the research questions may change during the course of the project as it becomes clearer what the challenges are, what the goals are, what the preliminary information coming out reveals. And you know, in the end, it's the benefits of the research are first and foremost for the community. So this is a much different way of research than traditionally the researcher going to the community, getting information, and then taking it out. Mm-hmm. And hopefully with some of that value going back to the community. But again, most of the value has been to the researcher to address their research questions, to help them complete their dissertation, or to publish and get tenure at the university. You know, so there's some very different value systems here.
So can you give some examples of the types of projects, aside from what you've already mentioned, that collaborators are engaging in, perhaps like very currently?
Okay, we're working with the Penobscot Tribe of Maine, and that's to deal with helping them set up both the Tribal Intellectual Property Issues Board of Review to help them identify, you know, what issues may be that are emerging in the communities, and to develop policies for, again, outside researchers coming in and offering short workshops in cultural sensitivity so that they become aware of the Penobscot values and can work with them more effectively on archaeological projects or other kinds of projects that bring researchers into the community. We're working with the Saginaw Chippewa Tribe in Michigan, and their concern is with a rock art site that has carved images in it, and that's currently owned by the state of Michigan. And for the Penobscot, or rather for the Saginaw Chippewa, that they see these images as teachings of the elders, teachings of the ancestors that are still very important to them, and several times a year they actually hold ceremonies there. The site is fenced off, but the park officials open the gate to the tribal members for certain ceremonies that they actually hold on these rock art images. And there's an interesting aspect to this. One of the images is of what's interpreted to be an archer. That is a man with a bow and arrow shooting an arrow. And a couple of tribal members some years ago wanted to use this image for a tribal sporting goods store, because it seemed to be a perfect image. And the elder said, no, that's not appropriate, because this person isn't hunting, they were shooting knowledge into the future. So, you know, here we have the cultural teachings that the tribal elders want to be used in certain ways, but not for commercial purposes. So that's another example. In New Zealand, we're working with the Moriori people, and that project is about developing a cultural database to record elders' knowledge of the cultural landscape and how places were used, how they should be used in the future. And this is a project that has involved young Moriori people videotaping and interviewing the elders, so they're reconnecting the generations, which is really important for this community.
While also making it more digital, too, which is a very interesting dimension.
And we're working in Australia with the Mannum River community, and they have developed a guidebook for a very famous archaeological rock art site, but their story of that place has never been told fully. So we have funded the guidebook that they've created and new signage for that site that brings forward their interpretation of this very important place to them. We're working with the Hopi in the Southwest to develop a history of their intellectual property and heritage policy development over the last 20 years. Working with the Yukon First Nations to develop or to explore how their legal regime relating to heritage intersects with that of the provincial government and to see how we can get the two of them to mesh more effectively. We're working in Kyrgyzstan, and there's nothing like trying to get a project going where they're having revolutions every other year. And that's a way to develop culturally sustainable heritage tourism, where the benefits are, where the projects are developed by the communities. They decide how they want to express themselves to tourists, and they're the ones who are the primary beneficiary. So, I mean, those are some examples of some things we're doing.
How does iPinch work as a method of decolonization?
Well, the first thing it does is it puts the communities in the driver's seat. The whole colonization process is, where people have been disenfranchised, they've lost their land or control over the land, they've lost control over their heritage. You've got the state and some guys that's, controlling how things are done. Even in BC, the archaeology permitting system is provincial, and yet you have many First Nations who are now developing their own policy because it's their heritage, mm-hmm. and they should be the ones making the decisions about it. And increasingly, the provincial archaeology branch is acknowledging and deferring to those. And that's the kind of decolonization. It's dealing with the power structure and both acknowledging, the traditional peoples of this land or whatever land, but acknowledging their right to, control their own destiny, their own heritage, their own affairs. That's very difficult to achieve, even within a discipline like archaeology, because most archaeologists are not willing to give up control over the research process, mm-hmm. Because they don't know what the outcome is going to be, or they feel that they're the experts and they should be the ones who control the project. But I think that there are many ways where one can work together or collaborate with others, and at the very least share in the decision making and ensure that the flow of benefits is equitable, and that's how we see a lot of the traditional problems that have plagued archaeology in the last several decades. Those are being diffused, and more Indigenous peoples are getting involved in archaeology, and I think the landscape is changing for the better as a result.
All right, so thank you for sitting down with me, George.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, it's been great.
Good.
This is Katina Danabasis. You were just listening to SFU, Ideas and Issues, speaking with archaeologist Dr. George Nicholas on behalf of the iPinch Project.
Intellectual Property Issues and Cultural Heritage.
For more information on iPinch, go to www.sfu.ca/iPinch.